including Japan, which I guess it's okay. It's Saturday in Japan, so okay, you know everything that's happened then through Friday night and Saturday morning, I presume. And so that would be Leslie. So Leslie, you ought to be able to tell us what the future holds, right? And if not, let me see. We've got people from all over, and I'm really, really glad to see you tonight. We are going to be doing a little seminar on my favorite economist, Paul Krugman. And my name is Bill Anderson. I teach at Frostburg State University. I'm also, I guess, forget what they call me now, some sort of associated scholar with the Mises Institute. And I went to Auburn University, and so that's where I got tied in with the Mises Institute. I was a fellow there, and then I've written a lot of things for them in the years since then. And so I really want to thank everybody at the Mises Institute, Lou Rockwell and Danny Sanchez and others for coming up with this really, really neat idea of being able to do webcasts and doing all sorts of fun stuff. And so I think that I really, I really, really appreciate this. And without any further ado, I'd like to get on this because I've got 58 PowerPoint slides, including this one. And I want to get through them fairly, fairly quickly, because what I'd like to do is go about, oh, 40, 45 minutes. It might take a little bit longer, I don't know. And then take questions from everybody, because there's, look, in order to truly write a book about the fallacies of Paul Krugman, you'd have to have Deforestation of North America for the single volume. And so we can't cover everything. I am going to miss some things, but nonetheless, you may have questions and something that I didn't cover, didn't answer for you. And by the way, during the session itself, if you want to send in a question, please do, okay? And what I will do is I will read the question and then try to answer it best I can, all right? So don't be afraid, if I'm in the middle of a slide, don't be afraid to go ahead and type a note to me. And I'm going to try to make sure that, that I keep up with everything there, okay? All right. So let us begin. Delusions of Krugman, all right? Who is Paul Krugman? Who is Paul Krugman? Okay. Well, unfortunately, he's a 2008 recipient of the Nobel Prize in Economics. Now, you have to understand my feelings about that. I remember that morning when I was looking at my computer, and I see this, and I start going, "Oh no! Oh no! Oh no!" And my wife says, "What's wrong? What's wrong?" I said, "Oh, this is just awful." And finally, she got it out of me. I said, "Paul Krugman got the Nobel in economics." And she said, "I thought maybe something had happened to one of your parents or something." I said, "Oh no, this is much worse, much worse." And so later that day, I get an email from Forbes.com. They asked if I would be willing to write a little, 700-word article or so on this August event. And so I did, and that's where the article Krugman in Wonderland came from. It didn't take very long to write it, but and I said that this was probably not as tragic an event as the sacking of Constantinople in 14, I think 56. But nonetheless, it was still pretty bad. All right, Krugman got his doctorate from MIT. And when he was there, Paul Samuelson was still ruling the roost. And Paul Samuelson is one of the people who really, in my view, really sort of corrupted economics. And he had a very, very strong personality on top of that. So he really moved it in a highly mathematical direction. But also, he helped let's just say, promote Keynesian economics in this country. I apologize. I do get a little bit of sore throat sometimes. You'll be seeing me sip water. All right. So that's where he got his doctorate. And he's taught at places. He's taught at MIT. He's taught at Stanford. He's now he's on the faculty of Princeton University. In fact, he was hired by none other than Ben Turn the Crank Bernanke, when Bernanke was department chair. Would be that Bernanke had stayed here as department chair. But anyway, of course, we all know him from his column. New York Times, he's a regular fixture on talk shows. We don't have TV reception at our house, so we need to keep some sanity. So I don't get to see Paul Krugman. I'm very glad. But nonetheless, if you ever watch the show, he's always on there. He's got two columns a week plus his blog with the New York Times. And lots of articles. Now, why should we, you know, why should Krugman interview? Why don't we just ignore him? I think part of, and there's two reasons why. I think number one, he is highly influential. He's probably the most influential economist in the world today, bar none. People listen to him, and boy, he's got a bunch of followers. But the second thing is, he messes with us, the Austrians. And not only does he mess with us and give off all the insults and the like, which I'll cover later on, but he didn't get it right. I mean, what he does is he creates these caricatures and straw men, and it's really, you know, it's really annoying, frankly. And so we don't like it. Okay. All right. Now, for example, the Austrian business cycle theory calls it the hangover theory, and then he writes this about it. He says, I regard the theory as being about as worthy of serious study as the Phlogiston theory of fire. Now, you've got to understand, this is what F.A. Hayek got his Nobel Prize for in 1974. So, I mean, he's ripping, you know, he's going after everybody on this. Yeah, exactly right. Arthur Ringwald makes a point. Samuelson wrote My Generation. Okay, guys, because I'm a bit older. Okay, I was in college. I was freshman in college 42 years ago. 42 years ago, I was just getting ready for cross-country camp because I ran track and cross-country at University of Tennessee back in the Stone Age. And everybody used Samuelson. Okay, that was the textbook of economics. And so, you know, the guy managed to get his claws in early and corrupt entire generations. Appreciate you bringing that up, Arthur. And he goes after Hazlitt. He says Hazlitt had a malign influence on economic policy. And he wrote, and I'm going to deal with this later. Hazlitt wrote many times editorials for the New York Times, always insisting that the answer to the Great Depression was to encourage big cuts in wages. And it's the sort of thing that, in other words, you look at that and say, boy, wasn't Hazlitt stupid? And you know, by the way, Hazlitt did not write that. I mean, what Hazlitt wanted was market wages, but as opposed to artificially high wages. But we'll get to that soon enough. Okay, he calls Austrians inflation fearmongers. They've been wrong about everything for 5 years, so why do they still get treated as authority figures? And he adds, Hazlitt has been wrong about everything for more than 80 years and is still regarded as a guru. Bad ideas, it appears, are extremely robust in the face of contrary evidence. So, all right, in other words, these are what you call fighting words. I mean, this is not something that you just, you know, that economists such as Austrians ignore, okay? And so his view is that there are two reasons why we're wrong. Number one, that we just have bad theory, okay? The second thing is because people in the Austrian school are just evil. They're bad people. They hate the poor. They want to cut wages. They want to do all sorts of terrible things. They want people to starve to death. They don't want anybody except rich people to have medical care. I mean, you know, I mean, you all of you know the drill, okay? And so, and you know, and it's one thing if you got some flunky making these statements, but literally with the best known economists in the world making these kinds of comments, it gets a little, you know, it starts getting personal. You know, as Don Corleone would say, it's not personal, it's business. Well, with Krugman, it's business and it's personal. All right, and so another thing, he's a partisan Democrat. And if you read his columns, I mean, he is a first and foremost a promoter of the Democratic Party. Most of us in academic economics believe that you really should not be a cheerleader for a political party, especially when you're talking about things like economic policy and the like. I mean, we're not, and especially bad policy, because I mean, look, let's face it. You know, politicians end up endorsing protectionism and inflation and the like, and you saw how well Paul, you know, Ron Paul has been treated by the Republican Party. And even though he was a member of that party, nonetheless, I mean, so, you know, Krugman does attack straw men, but he does hate Ron Paul too. But, you know, he wants to tie the economy to the tyranny of gold. And we just don't like government. All right. So that's, you know, that's a lot, you know, part of it. Okay. Here, what else he says? Okay. Substance aside, not that substance isn't important. Austrian economics very much has the psychology of a cult. Its devotees believe that they have access to a truth that generations of mainstream economists have somehow failed to discern. They go wild at any suggestion that maybe they're the ones who have an intellectual blind spot. And as with all cults, the failure of prophecy, in this case, the prophecy of soaring inflation from deficits and monetary expansion, only strengthen the determination of the faithful to uphold the faith. So, all right, so therefore we're wrong, stupid, and we are evil. All right, so it's not business, it's personal, okay? Unfortunately, you know, again with Krugman, it's personal. Austrians are not just bad economists, they're bad people. And Nick Gillespie from Reason Magazine recently had a piece in the Daily Beast on Krugman, and he makes a point. Says earlier in this year, in fact, Krugman managed to offend some of the staunchest ideological confreres in a blog post meditating on why he is always right. Curse him, sure. Krugman briefly considers the remote possibility that he was stacking the deck by either unfairly cherry-picking data or opponents to his own advantage. Nah, the super scientist concluded before offering up this irrefutable hypothesis. Maybe I actually am right, and maybe the other side actually does contain a remarkable number of vague fools. Okay, so, all right. Yeah, that's exactly. Yeah, I think, you know, Travis makes a good point too, that the he wrote a piece on libertarian populism. He doesn't get the stuff right. I mean, you know, it's one thing if the guy gets something right. And I didn't, by the way, Travis, I don't have that in this presentation tonight. I'm very familiar with it, but you know, again, and you'll see the way I'm going why I left that out. But I really want to explain. Okay. You know, I want to set the stage for understanding this is the guy, this is what we're, you know, that I'm going to be arguing against, okay? And he's also claimed that he's just a lonely voice in the wilderness. And everybody, you know, government policy in Washington, they don't listen to him. They're following austerity. And when they should be ramping up spending and borrowing, they're not doing that. He screws up a lot of things. You know, he said that I think that, you know, when the Republicans recently had a vote in which they separated the food stamp program from the farm bill, he accused the Republicans of wanting to cut food stamps by 95%. Well, what he did was he took all the projected so-called cuts over the next 10 years and put them in 1 year, you know, which is something a good mathematician or a good statistician would not do. But Krugman is, let's just say he's beyond all that. All right. And he says that, oh, my gosh, it's been quite a year, not just this, you know, sea change in professional opinion on structural unemployment, but the collapse of the expansionary austerity doctrine and its replacement by the view that multipliers are quite large, the collapse of the 90% debt threshold view, the plunging deficit, and the vanishing of medium-term debt concerns and more. In other words, don't have anything to worry about. We can borrow into into oblivion, and it's okay. But he says, that this lonely prophet here, policy hasn't changed at all, and elite views have hardly shifted. How is this possible? Politicians seek out economists who reinforce their prejudice. News media are either propaganda organs or desperately afraid of declaring in any straightforward way the politicians are wrong, no matter how much they say is at odds with the truth. Now, here's an interesting point. I pretty much know the circle of, the Austrians, who at least are in an academic position, okay? I don't know of anybody who gets contacted by all these people in Washington to set policy. Ask Joe Salerno, ask Mark Thornton, Walter Block. These guys are not, if you listen to Krugman, you think that we're the ones, making policy, when in fact, people listen to Krugman a lot more than they listen to us. And, you think this guy was like the prophet Isaiah. He ran naked through Judah, preaching repentance, but he was ignored and vilified, all right? And yet, and part of it is because we do criticize. Now, why do we criticize? I think if I could put it in just one term, it would be because what he does is to promote what we call the broken window fallacy. That is that's a major point. He really, and we're going to get into that and give a lot of examples. One of the things I am going to show is why Austrians believe, what Austrians do believe, and why we believe that he's mistaken. Okay, in other words, I want to actually have some substance as opposed to just quoting him and saying, oh man, look at this, it's terrible. Okay. All right. Now, I remember August the 15th, 2011. And why? Because I was in the JFK airport, and we were adopting a girl from Latvia, and my wife and I were preparing to fly there to stay about a month. And so I looked up at the TV, and it's a CNN show, Fareed Zakar, I think his name. And Paul Krugman's on there with Ken Rogoff from Harvard. But they didn't have the sound up. And I turned to my wife and I said, I have no desire to turn that sound up. I want to have a pleasant flight. I don't want to be thinking about Krugman. And so turns out I get there the next morning. I've got all these emails from people saying, man, can you believe it? Well, it turned out that what Krugman said on there was, if we discovered, that space aliens were planning to attack, and we needed a massive buildup to counter the space alien threat, and really inflation and budget deficits took secondary place to that, this slump would be over in 18 months. All right, now, you got to understand, folks, that's a hyperbolic statement, but he believes it. All right, then he added, though, hey, and if we found out that they weren't going to invade, all that money would have been well spent because we would have had more spending and therefore that would have ramped up the economy. And so what are good times? Well, World War II. And he writes that, it's actually negative social spending and yet it brought us out of the Great Depression. He said, and deficit spending during World War II created an economic boom, and the boom laid the foundation for long-run prosperity. Overall debt in the economy, public plus private, actually fell as a percentage of GDP thanks to economic growth and, yes, some inflation, which reduced the real value of outstanding debts. Now, after the war, thanks to the improved financial position of the private sector, the economy was able to thrive without continuing deficits. A lot of contradictory stuff there, and as we go on, but nonetheless, I include this statement because I think it's very useful for people to understand how he thinks. He's a true Keynesian, and Keynesians believe it's all aggregate demand. And if people stop spending, then government has to do it either by printing money and tossing it out there or by borrowing and directing it, you know, to whomever. And what he believes is we're talking about real life fiscal policy, you know, where these really smart economists are sitting around and they're thinking, okay, what does the economy need? All right. And so therefore it needs more spending by the government. And Krugman wants us to believe that politicians don't want to spend money. I mean, it's amazing. Of course they do. What about, hey, here's another idea. What about terrorism? Well, this is what he wrote a few days after 9/11. First, the driving force behind the economic slowdown has been a plunge in business investment. Now, all of a sudden, we need some new office buildings. As I've already indicated, the destruction isn't big compared with the economy, but rebuilding will generate at least some increase in business spending. All right, folks, this isn't just the broken window. This is the broken window theory or fallacy on steroids. I mean, and big steroids, too. And so what he's, you know, I mean, I remember reading that and just kind of scratching my head. And by the way, I'm going to keep going on. The attack opens the door to some sensible recession-fighting measures. He talks about, you know, that should we have a classic Keynesian response to economic slowdown, temporary burst of public spending. So there are plausible economics, but it's questionable whether Congress could agree on how to spend the money and time to be in use. And there was also the certainty that conservatives would refuse to accept any such move unless we were tied to another round of irresponsible long-term tax cuts. Now it seems that we will indeed get a quick burst of public spending. How tragic the reasons. Okay, folks, this is broken window theory, all right? Or I keep saying theory. I mean, I'm quoting, I forget his name, this guy who's on these talk shows sometimes. He used to have a bad cocaine habit. But at any rate, but nonetheless, okay, I think the stage is set. We understand how he thinks. Government spending will bring the economy back. Booms are good for the economy. In fact, it was World War II created a boom, and that boom laid a foundation for economic growth. Okay, file that away. I'm going to come back to it later on, but understand. Larry Kudlow. That's who it was, Larry Kudlow. I hate to. I mean, you know, it's not that I want to go after somebody personally or anything like that, but Kudlow right after 9/11 talked about, well, we have this broken window theory that says if you spend, you know, all this public spending will ramp up the economy. You know, you're thinking about the losses, just the, you know, the unbelievable losses, you know, of people that came from 9/11. Somehow this is good for the economy. You know, if that's really what we need to do, then folks, I'll tell you what, instead of trying to stop terrorism, what we really should have done was say, hey, guys, please come to the United States, blow up more buildings. We need the work. You know, we need prosperity. Please come and give us prosperity. And, you know, under that thing, Osama bin Laden shouldn't have been, you know, vilified. The man, you know, he should have been regarded as a public benefactor. All right. And so this, again, this is the mentality that we're dealing with. Okay, Keynesianism creates a mentality, and it does lead folks, I think, to logical, stupid conclusions. All right. So, war's good for the economy, gear up for space aliens, killing a few thousand people and knocking down some buildings is good for the economy. All right. Is this reasonable thinking? Well, they make sense in Keynesianism, all right? All right, and look, Krugman wasn't the first person to say World War II brought the United States out of the Great Depression. I remember taking a history class in high school, and they said the same thing. We were discussing the New Deal. We're covering that period of time, and everybody agreed that, well, it really wasn't the New Deal that ended the Great Depression. It was World War II. And even though I don't have it cited here, Robert Higgs did a very, very good piece in the Journal of Economic History in 1992. If you Google that, you know, Robert Higgs, World War II Journal of Economic History, you can find, I think also the Independent Institute has that particular piece. But he pointed out how, in fact, World War II did, you know, World War II lowered the rate of unemployment, but it was not good for the economy. Right? And so, I mean, he really, Higgs goes right at the heart of the theory, and he looks at the results. And I think this is really important because Keynesians are very much in this whole, well, look, what happens, and in fact, what happens after, you know, if something happens after an event, why then it must be because we did this. If we did this, something happens, then there's always a straight causality. And with him, with Krugman, it's the economy has been in the toilet since 2008, all during the presidency of Barack Obama. It could not possibly be anything that Obama has done except not spend enough. It's those Republicans who are, you know, and I refer to it as Goldstein on my own blog on Krugman. You know, I talk about Goldstein and, you know, from 1984. And even when the Democrats had absolute, you know, veto, I mean, every proof majorities in the House and the Senate and the President of the United States, he was still claiming the Republicans were holding back economic growth. Well, how could they do it? They couldn't, you know, not, you know, so that's, you know, that's how Obamacare got, you know, got passed. Did a little vote stealing in Minnesota and gave us, whoever that senator is, and can't think of his name right now, the comedian, the guy who used to be on Saturday Night Live. But, but anyway, that you got to understand, this is the mentality, okay? And so what we've got, yeah, Al Franken, yeah, that's exactly who he is. And, yeah, there's a lot of, you know, again, you know, it's how he got in, which is kind of interesting, but he'll probably get reelected next year, as they always do. Okay. Now, what else is Krugman saying? He said, look, the economies are mired in a huge liquidity trap. Okay, so let's look at what they mean by a liquidity trap. If you want to read Krugman, you're going to see him. He's going to talk about liquidity traps a lot. You know, he pretty much repeats a lot of the same stuff, okay? And this is in his own words. From the very beginning of the Lesser Depression, the central policy for understanding macroeconomic policy has been that everything is different when you're in a liquidity trap. In other words, to be very honest, what he's really trying to say is there's no such thing as opportunity costs, and the law of scarcity is held in abeyance during a liquidity trap. Now, he would never say that outright, but there's the implication that that's the case. In particular, the whole case for fiscal stimulus and against austerity rests upon the proposition that with interest up, rates up against the zero lower bound, the central bank can neither achieve full employment on its own nor offset the contractionary effect of spending cuts or tax hikes. Okay. Although Krugman, by the way, he has called for tax hikes. He, when it looked like all of the Bush era tax cuts were going, including the ones that would have raised my annual tax rate by about $6,000, Krugman actually wrote that we should go ahead and let all of them expire. So he did call for, and he said, then we can spend the money on something and fire up the economy. Okay. So, I mean, so it's, you have to understand, I mean, the guy probably, he loves all the taxes, okay? Well, I need to let you know that at a conference, it was at the Southern Economic Association meetings in 2004 in New Orleans, and I was sitting next to Joe Salerno, and Krugman had a seminar in which he spoke, and I had the first question, and I asked him, I said, are you advocating that we go back to the 70% rates that we had before 1981, he goes, oh, no, those rates were insane. Those were his very words. All right. So, you know, I just leave it to you. Next time you read something, you know, where he basically wants to cope back with his rage, remember that he's endorsing what he once called insanity. All right. Now, it's time to switch over to the Austrians a little bit. Let's look, what does Murray Rothbard say about the liquidity trap? Okay. Because Austrians are very aware of the liquidity trap, and they are aware of the arguments that are being made for it, okay? And I think that's important to keep in mind. We're not ignorant of it. It's not that we don't understand the thinking behind it. It's that we disagree with it. But what does Rothbard say? The ultimate weapon in the Keynesian arsenal of explanations of depressions is the liquidity trap. This is not precisely a critique of the Mises theory. That's a business cycle theory. But it is the last line of Keynesian defense of their own inflationary cures for depression. Keynesians claim that liquidity preference, that is demand for money, may be so persistently high that the rate of interest could not fall low enough to stimulate investment sufficiently to raise the economy out of the depression. All right. By the way, that's another way of saying what you just read from Krugman, okay? So, you know, Rothbard wrote this around 1962, but nonetheless, I mean, I think this is proof he did understand this thing. And so, in other words, if you want to understand the arguments that Krugman is making right now, okay, you have to understand that Keynesians consider this liquidity trap to be a special case, or what sometimes they call the Keynesian case, or, you know, the Keynes case, one that can only be cured by a blitz of government spending. Why? Because consumers aren't going to spend, and businesses, seeing a lack of aggregate demand, aren't going to invest. Okay, so there's where the downward spiral comes, and so you've got to have government, you know, the deus ex machina, stepping in, reaching in, spending, bringing all these new dollars, and what happens, according to the Keynesians, is that over time, in fact, in a short time, this dollar starts spreading, businesses start saying, oh, we're going to have more spending, the economy's going to be great. They start investing, and as Krugman says, the economy gets traction, starts moving on its own, and then it continues. All right, that's the argument. Okay. And what he says is this, basically, and I've read this enough time from him, that if you do not believe in the liquidity trap, then you're willfully blind. And therefore, World War II, as a great stimulus program, 9/11 and space aliens as stimulus programs, make sense in this regard, okay, in a liquidity trap. And I remember a couple of years ago, I was at a conference in New York at the New York Fed, and I wrote about it in the Mises Institute, you know, in the Mises page. It's called Learning to Love the Fed. And I went to this conference there, and we were upstairs in this auditorium, and these economists from the Fed were making presentations, and they would have Q&A, and I was kind of sitting back, and I was thinking of myself more like Statler and Waldorf from the Muppets. If you remember, there's two old men up there sitting up in the balcony making smart comments, and so I never did the Q&A because I was afraid I was really going to say something that would tick everybody off. So I just stayed back and listened. And I remember that a faculty member from Dartmouth got up there, and he all of a sudden, when are people going to realize that we are in a liquidity trap? You know, like he had said something that was really, really deep. Okay. These folks believe this stuff. All right. And, you know, I mean, he said that the Keynesian argument, in a sense, makes sense. It's easy to understand, okay? You look, okay, and so what you have to do is go at it head on. You have to, you know, explain why it is this is not good theory, all right? So let's look at some Austrians versus Keynesians. While repeating Krugman's admonition to prepare to fight off the assault of little green men from Mars and humorists, we have a much better case against Krugman and the Keynesians than just say their idea sounds stupid. And what I want to do in the following slides, I want to lay out exactly where the paradigms collide, okay, and lay out the Austrian case. So that's what I want to do in this next thing. Are there any questions so far about where we've gone? I mean, don't, like I said, I don't want to be afraid at all to ask a question. I hope everybody's okay with it. All right, I'm gonna keep going. Okay, we're gonna look at capital and interest because, thanks Travis. We're gonna look at capital and interest. Folks, let me tell you something. If you really want, I mean, well, there's a lot of places, you know, people think, well, the Austrians are free market people. Whatever. Our contribution to economics, and this is a major one, is capital theory. Why? Because, frankly, most of the mainstream people don't have it. I never learned capital theory in all of graduate school. I could, you know, folks, I could do a border hashing. I could solve that Lagrangian multiplier, create that cost function, and create a utility function, baby. I mean, I could, you know, lay out equilibrium until the cows came home. But I couldn't have explained to you anything about capital except what I was learning over at the Mises Institute because we didn't teach it. All we taught was that nice big K. We got capital here. All right, we're going to put capital into the, you know, into the mix. And where did it come from? Who cares? It came, you know, it's here. Okay. And interest. Okay. The Austrians, really, we look at time in a very, very different way than people in the mainstream because we look at time not simply as how you react against changes, but rather because of short run and long run, which is, you know, the mainstream time. It's really the Marshallian time. But we look at time, what is the real effect as the production period over a period of time? And lengthening and shortening production cycles, what does that mean? And I think this is really, you know, it's something that if you want to understand Austrian economics, read about capital and interest. I think that's where we really stand out. Okay, now, if you look in the tradition of Karl Menger, Mises, Murray Rothbard, and I left out Von Bawerk, I should have had him in there. But capital, or identify capital as higher order goods, okay? In other words, you've got an order of goods from the highest order, and highest order would mean, you know, like the raw materials, and all the way to the goods of the lowest order, which are the consumer goods. And so they identify capital. These are higher order goods, all right? They're created in the process of production and are used either to create other capital goods or to produce consumption goods. Now, here's something interesting. I'm going to toss this in as an aside. I'm not going to really do anything with it. But Rothbard makes the case that the factors of land and labor with capital, ultimately capital itself goes back to the factors of land and labor. So he does not include capital as a factor of production. Okay, that instead it's land and labor, but he would say capital is a higher order good. Now, where does it come from? Okay, this is where time comes in. Capital has to be accumulated, and it's accumulated by saving. All right, and the rate of saving within an economy is going to allow for more capital or less. Okay, if you have high levels of saving, you're going to be able to have more capital formation. Why? Two reasons. Number one, because the funds are available. But the second reason is also because a high level of savings is going to I agree with you, Travis, on that, your comment. But what's going to happen, okay, is that people are foregoing some present consumption. Obviously, we cannot forego all present consumption unless we want to starve to death. But there foregoing some present consumption and saving. Why? So they can consume later. Okay, they're not just hoarding or whatever. I mean, they want to be able to spend. They want to have an income later. Even if you can talk about people hoarding goods or whatever, they're still wanting to consume at some point in the future. They want to make sure that they can consume at some point in the future. That's, I think, something important that, you know, Keynesians, to them, they look at saving as being just utterly ridiculous. I mean, the Keynesian multiplier is one over the savings rate. So let's say, for example, you spend 90% of your income and you spend and you save 10%. So therefore, the multiplier then is 1 over 0.1 or 1 over 0.10, which is equal to 10. Okay, now if you only save 5%, the multiplier is 1 over 0.05, which is 20. And if you save only 1% of your income, then it's the multiplier is 100. Okay, wow. All right, so in the Keynesian thing, the multiplier makes the economy grow. So, by the way, Keynes did say if you have zero savings rate, well, then somehow you'll have massive inflation and everything will get out of control. But you can understand these multipliers come about because people don't save. All right. So, in other words, it's built into their system of thinking that the less saving we have, the stronger the economy is good. Again, they hate cash, you know. But, you know, what they talk about what Keynes talks about, the paradox of thrift. What they say is, you know, it's good if one person saves because they're wanting to lay a nest egg or whatever. But if everybody saves all at once, that's bad. That's going to drive the economy down. It's going to drive down aggregate demand for consumer goods, and therefore nobody will invest. Okay, that's the thinking. And I'll get into that even more later on. Okay, the value of capital within an economy rests with its fitting into a structure of production that is put together over time. All right, we talk about low time preference, people willing to forego some in order to consume more later. The structure, okay, if you have, in other words, a low time preference means a high savings rate, and that also means that you can have a longer structure of production. Okay, you can build more complex capital. Okay, if you think, let me give you an example, guys, about complexity in capital. The first computers we know, personal computer that Wozniak and Jobs created was in a garage. They were able to make it in a garage, little garage, okay? It's a fairly simple, crude piece of work. Could an Apple computer today be made in a garage? No, no way. I mean, there are just too many parts. The process is much more complex, or what Mark Skousen refers to as capital deepening. All right, and so I think that it's really, really important, you know, to keep in mind that that formation of capital is something the Austrians really understand. I mean, Keynesians just laugh all this off. There's no such thing as a structure of production. It's just K, it's capital. And not only that, and I don't have this in the slides, but if you read Krugman, what he believes is that the value of capital lies in the spending for it at the time it's being created. So he talks about, remember when the new iPhone came out? I think it was the iPhone 5 or something like that. And he had some blog posts and a column about, hey, is this going to help revitalize the economy because people are going to junk their old iPhones and buy new ones? So we're going to have more spending. Completely ignores opportunity cost here. But nonetheless, yeah, that's kind of how the Keynesian thinking goes. People just spend. If you spend, doesn't matter where it comes from, just as long as you spend. All right, and capital is not just a homogeneous blob, okay? And I need to probably start going a little more quickly because I do want to get some questions, and I don't want to hold you here all night. But it's not just a homogeneous blob, folks. It's an interweaving structure of capital goods that's tied together through the rate of interest. And, you know, we've seen throughout this volume how free market, we have a price system that puts stuff together. This is Rothbard saying, okay? He looks, he says, the profits and losses, all these things, adjust output, they send the signals, the proper signals to, yeah, Arthur, you're right. Absolutely right. I mean, the Krugman say, oh, all money go to Apple stores and then they'll all spend it and we'll all, you know, get rich and that. But the idea here is that, as he's saying, is that we have a system in place if we let it work. And, you know, it's worked well over the years. All right. And what's the balance? What's the thing that has the balancing act? It's a prevailing rate of interest, because interest is a function of both time preference on behalf of the borrower, because after all, what are you wanting to do when you borrow? You want goods now, you want present goods. If you remember in It's a Wonderful Life, Mr. Potter talks about, you know, they should be saving thrift. And say, well, Mr. Potter, what, save until they are old and broken down and can't even enjoy a house? And so therefore, you know, pushing homeownership and the like. And so we borrow. We want a car. Hey, we don't pay cash. We borrow. We have car payments, all right? And a few years ago, I bought a Subaru and did not check the VIN number. That was a big mistake. Found out the thing had been called salvage at one time and then illegally sold. And so I told my mechanic, I said, I really don't need a mechanic. I need an exorcist for this car. But nonetheless, okay, the Austrians hold, okay, that interest, it's determined by the market for the exchange of present goods against future goods. All right. In other words, you save, you're going to be purchasing future goods, but you're also creating the mechanism to be able to create those future goods. All right. And so the Austrians say, when government steps in and tries to create a false interest rate, which is what the central bank will do, it sends the wrong signals, and that is where the problem comes from. All right. And in the Austrian business cycle, you know, that according to the Keynesians, it occurs because, well, we have a downturn because there's a sudden lack of aggregate demand for goods. Okay. But what Austrians say is, look, what's going on is that you have the government pushing down an interest rate. It's encouraging borrowing in lines of production that cannot be sustained over time. And it's those lines of production that are going to be hit hardest at the beginning. You know, we had the housing boom, right? And we saw what happened. I mean, we knew, by the way, Peter Schiff, Mark Thornton wrote in 2004, that this thing was going to end very badly. I remember in the spring of 2006, I was appealing a tax rate on my house. And I told the board of Allegheny County, Maryland at the time that it's, I don't want to see something, but I just want to see, but nonetheless, you know, that I told them, I said, guys, I said, this is going to come to an end, and do not make future spending decisions on what you see now. This is not a normal market. This is going to end very badly. And they just laughed at me, told me I didn't know what I was talking about. And he said, oh, we don't see that happening. And, you know, they saw it happening later on, of course. But in with the Austrians, okay, here's a huge difference. Krugman believes booms are good and that government spending should be done to continue the boom. All right? And, by the way, it's not just him. I remember Martin Feldstein, shortly after the housing bust really became, and we had a big financial crisis, you know, tied to it, he wrote a piece in the Wall Street Journal saying that the government has to come up with a plan to force back up housing prices, because unless they do that, we're going to go into recession. And so, in other words, the very thing that was causing the trouble with Feldstein is saying, we need more of it. But with the Austrians, what we say, the booms are a time of wasteful spending and investment. They're essentially financed with borrowed money, okay? All right, and then much of that borrowed money actually goes for consumption. Okay, and it's very clear that lines of production and investment cannot be sustained. They have to be abandoned, and that's, you know, you have the crisis and you have to abandon them. Okay, and then you, and it's the Austrians point out, you have to either liquidate these malinvested resources or, if possible, transfer them to other uses that are sustainable. All right, and but Austrians point out, without this liquidation of some of these malinvestments, it's not that they can't be transferred, they need to be liquidated, that is sold, or, you know, some situations abandoned, like they did with houses. I mean, whole housing areas literally had to be torn down. And even after they had spent, you know, millions of dollars building them, they literally tore them down. Okay? They had to, because there was nothing else. They couldn't sell them. All right? And that was a form of liquidation. Okay? But what happens is then the Keynesians come back and say, aha! Look at it. You're cheerleaders for recession and liquidation, and they call them liquidationists. What they want is, boy, they want people out of work. They want to see people suffer. All right? And this is where Krugman comes in. Calls it the hangover theory. All right? He says it's seductive because, in essence, it's a morality play. Okay? Austrians see this boom and people really doing well, and we don't like it. And what we say is that, oh, man, there's this hubris, and, you know, you've been bad, bad people, and now you have to pay by having mass unemployment. And then he gives the Keynesian position, okay? He says that they have to be, these seductions, the hangover theory has to be resisted. Recessions are not necessary consequences of boom. They can and should be fought not with austerity, but with liberality, with policies that encourage to spend more, not less. Now, he wrote this in 1998, okay? So you can see that his position for the last 15 years, at least, has been very, very consistent, okay? But I think he lays it out. Of course, he creates the straw man with the Austrians. Okay, and then says, man, look at this, these idiotic people believe in. I mean, they want people to suffer. It's a morality play with that. Okay, and so in the last downturn, he says, well, you know, we've got a $14 trillion hole. And by the way, Bill Clinton, you know, repeated that in his book on how to fix the economy. And so how do we do it? Well, massive government spending. And so how do you, but because tax revenues go down during these downturns, what happens? Well, we've got to go through borrowing and printing money. And in fact, Krugman argues that since interest rates are, quote, at historically low levels, therefore, it's free money. And he had a blog post one time, free money, okay, that this is, okay, free money. We don't have to worry about it at all. And we owe it to ourselves. It's like this, hey, folks, there is this real neat little trick. If we borrow ourselves and we owe it to ourselves, we really don't have to pay it back, okay? We can just continue to get rich without really having to work for it, okay? Without having to create anything. We just print money, all right? Now, David Gordon did a response to the hangover theory, and he points out that it's a theory of malinvestment. All right, it's not about irrational exuberance, even though it occurs during a boom. He says that, you know, look, I mean, and for that matter, look at what happened during the dot-com bubble, okay? People were saying, oh, the government, by raising tax rates from 33% to 39.6%, created a new economy. We're hearing this all, and if you remember 15 years ago, 14 years ago, we have the new economy. Well, it wasn't a very new economy. It was a bubble. It was a you know, boom, that's right, Helicopter Ben, exactly right. And Ben, you know, and Bernanke has said, look, I mean, he believes the same thing. He says, look, if I have to drop money from a helicopter and, you know, give it, and that's the way it gets to people so they can spend, I'll do that. So far, though, I've not seen any helicopters. I've not seen the black helicopters or the Fed helicopters, any helicopters over my house, dropping money anyway. All right, Gordon makes another point. Krugman introduces false issue by bringing in unemployment. It's not all part of Mises Hayek view that liquidating malinvestments caused by overexpansion of bank credit requires mass unemployment. Quite the contrary, unemployment in its Austrian C matter stems mainly from rigid wage rates. If workers accept the fall in wages, liquidation of the boom is compatible with full employment. Now, understand something. Keynes knew this, but what did Keynes say? Keynes said, well, the way you give the workers this wage cut, because workers are going to fight hard to hold on to their money wage, and, you know, wages are sticky downward, and Krugman's used that term too. So therefore, if we can have inflation, we can have the wage cut, because as Keynes wrote in General Theory, the workers are only interested in their, what do you call it, their money wage. They don't care about the real wage. All they care about is, you know, the size of the wage in their paycheck. Okay? All right. So what does Krugman do, though? What he says is, well, see, Austrians are calling for everybody's money wage to be cut, but if you cut everybody's wages, there's no advantage. No, Austrians are not saying that. We're saying some wages are going to need to fall, but what you're doing really is you're getting things back into balance. All right, and this is something that, because the Keynesians really do not care much about factors of production, the homogeneous blob, all right, capital, labor, whatever, it's just a K and an L that you put into a, you know, into these mathematical functions. And so what you're really talking about in the period of the recession and following the collapse of the boom is the reestablishing of these relative values of factors of production. Okay, these are, in other words, what, given people's time preferences, given preferences that people have, this is going to be what, in other words, you're going to see the relative prices getting back to the relationships that they should have in order for production to be sustainable. Okay, he's not saying cut everybody's wages. And by the way, I mean, Hazlitt never wrote that. What they talked about was reestablishing the relative prices, okay? Because what happens is a boom distorts them. In the boom, people in unsustainable lines of work, that's where the money is going. That's where the wages and the salaries are going up. That's where the commissions are being had. People are getting rich. It cannot be sustained. Those people are going to have to take a haircut. All right, and it's very, very frustrating because, you know, it's obvious, but to them it's not obvious. All right, now, what's Krugman's explanation? Okay, on the recession, happens when, for whatever reason, a large part of the private sector tries to increase its cash reserves at the same time. Yet, for all simplicity, the insight that a slump is about an excess demand for money makes nonsense of the whole hangover theory. And to fix the problem, print money. Okay, in other words, that all of a sudden, people have this huge demand for money. They're scared, they don't want to spend anymore, they want to save, okay? And they're all saving, they're not spending, and it's driving down, okay? Time check, thanks. Okay, I'm going to move quickly through that because we do need to have a question and answer. Okay, how does Krugman want to fix the problem? Well, you know, he said, well, fine, junk the bad investments and write off the bad loans. You know, by the way, Austrians say that too. Why should this require that perfectly good productive capacity be left idle? Well, he doesn't ask the question why, you know, about malinvestments. In other words, that what he's saying is that, hey, we, you know, it's like saying, well, look, those houses in, that they built out there in California, they shouldn't tear them down. They should leave. Those are perfectly good houses, right? They should sell them. Find some, I mean, why should those houses be left idle? We can find some way, something, some people will put into them, you know? We'll take all the homeless people and we'll put them in one neighborhood or something. Who knows? But this is the way that these folks are thinking. All right. Okay, in Krugman's world, capital's homogeneous. By the way, labor's homogeneous. You've got this big pot, like what Bob Higgs likes to say, you know, tongue in cheek, is this big pot of goo, you know, and you just toss money into it, you stir money, and out of it comes this economy. Now, you know, it's kind of like, remember in the book of Exodus, when Moses comes down from Mount Sinai and he finds the people of Israel worshiping a golden calf, and he asks his brother Aaron, where'd this come from? Aaron says, well, I threw a bunch of gold in the fire, and out of it just came this golden calf. Okay. Well, basically, in the, you know, the Keynesian view, you throw enough money into it, out of it comes an economy. It gains traction. And that's that. All right. If only, okay, this view, capital is homogeneous, and so more capital, the better. And the value of capital, though, is the spending that's on it, okay? It, you know, yeah, they'll say, yeah, it's a tool and it's good and all that, but the capital advances on its own, and all you need to do is just make money available. The government can make money available for capital. That's just fine. All right, and so, which means if capital were malleable, there would be no real concern of credit expansion. Okay, there would be no misallocation, just minor convenience. In reality, misallocations are wasted resources, okay, including precious and scarce time. All right, in other words, malinvested capital is not useful in the present economy. All right, the idea of interest, too, okay, with the Keynesians believe that interest is, quote, a reward for parting with liquidity. And what Austrians say, no, it's based on time preference. Both the supply, the people who are willing to supply the loanable funds are willing to wait, you know, for some consumption, and others want to be able to have present goods now for investment, to be able to make goods in the future. And so therefore with Krugman, the rate of interest then, if it is simply a tool of aggregate demand, then it's the government's duty to drive it down as much as possible, because after all, you know, yeah, it discourages savings, and that's good because then people have to spend, and the more they spend, the better off the economy is going to be. And then what he points out is, why should business expand? Now, you know, he said, obviously, we're not worried about malinvested capital. What we have is just a lack of consumer spending. And so all we have to do is get the government to come in there and spend more, and that's what will bring, you know, bring us out. And whereas the Austrians are going to say, look, folks, we have to ask, why is capital idle in the first place? Are we talking about malinvested capital? And what happens? The government continues, probably politically speaking, you know, with Keynesians, they never get into the politics of it, of government spending. You know, it's just always these wise people just spending where it needs to be spent. And you're going to see some interesting stuff. And it's not a lack of consumption that leads to idle capital. It's malinvestment. If you try to continue to sustain these things, you are taking resources from elsewhere. The law of scarcity still holds during a recession. All right. Okay, there's the question here. Suppose people buy gold and silver with all that printed money. Well, that's true. And what will happen to the price of gold and silver? Well, you know, it goes up, okay, which is what happened. You have a lot of printed money and the price of gold and silver goes up. So that's and the people, by the way, the people come in early. They're the ones that people were buying gold at $250 an ounce, they're the ones doing a lot better than the people who are, you know, coming in and buying it at $1,500 an ounce. All right. The other thing is Krugman ignores the entrepreneur. And this is very important. In fact, all mainstream economics does this. The entrepreneur really doesn't, to Krugman, an entrepreneur is just some guy starts a business in his garage. And, you know, what they don't see is the larger issue. Entrepreneurs are the ones that move the resources from lower value to higher value uses. And profits and losses are signals to entrepreneurs about what is going to work and what is not. And this is totally lost on people like Krugman because they don't understand what the entrepreneur is, what the entrepreneur does. And I think if you really want to get a good picture of it, read Rothbard and Mises. They really have, I think they are the best when it comes to understanding entrepreneurship. And also, I would recommend you reading Peter Klein's book through the Mises Institute. You can also get it as a PDF download. I see your question, Wes. The capitalist and the entrepreneur and the capitalist and the entrepreneur, I think is what it is. It's a number of papers, but I use it for my own classes too. And it's very, very good. Okay. Does the funding of Solandra represent a malinvestment? Yes, absolutely. In fact, I want to talk about that in a second. All right. This, and by the way, it's mind-boggling what I'm going to read you now. Instead of entrepreneurs energizing the economy by directing resources from lower value to higher value uses, Krugman believes that the government can create prosperity by forcing up business costs. Okay, this is what he wrote recently about the EPA's new mandate that's going to force the shutting down of some coal-fired electric power plants. All right. Environmental action actually could have a positive effect. Suppose that electric utilities, in order to meet the new rules, decide to close some existing power plants and invest in new lower emission capacity. Well, that's an increase in spending, and more spending is exactly what our economy needs. All right, now I'm going to be honest, folks, that one does tend to blow me away. In the business cycle, yeah. Okay, Zachary, you're absolutely right. When we're talking, this is the post-crisis, okay? The post-boom, post-crisis, and what do we have? We have the government subsidizing companies like Solandra that could never make a profit in a free market. Now, Krugman would say that's because consumers are myopic. They don't understand just what a horrible thing burning coal is and how it's killing all of us. Don't you remember Harry Reid in 2008? Oil makes us sick. Coal makes us sick. All right? And I don't even go into what that means, but nonetheless, you see, that's the problem. Okay. And there's some stuff there. Yeah, Peter Klein does cover that very, very well. But I mean, this blows me away. I mean, in other words, that you take perfectly good capital and you shut that down and you go to something that makes something at a higher cost, uses more resources, cannot make a profit unless the government shovels money in or tries to, in essence, stack the deck to force people to use that. And, yeah. Raises electricity costs, which of course what lowers our real income. Okay, and so it moves supply curves to the left, and makes us poor. But what these guys, what they're saying is higher business costs create more prosperity. I mean, it's amazing, but that's what he's saying. So what are the implications? Okay. Economic growth comes about by forcing up business costs because businesses will then be forced to spend more money. More spending brings prosperity. Look, that turns economic logic on its head. Standards of living increase not because governments force up production costs, but rather because entrepreneurs find ways to use fewer resources to create more wealth. In other words, that actually we lower the real price of things, which then means they can be available to more people. And that is what capitalism has done, and that's what Krugman totally just, he doesn't get it. He's hostile to capitalism. And so that's what, you know, I get, okay, conclusion, yes, and then conclusion. It's unfortunate that an economist does not understand. We're talking basic economics. We're talking opportunity cost. Okay, and understand that the world's most influential economist does not understand opportunity cost. And it's got a huge following. And by the way, and don't kid yourself, the White House coordinates, I mean, he coordinates talking points with his column and all that. Let's just say that there's just too many coincidences on what you're hearing from the White House and what you're hearing from Krugman. I am sure that they're in touch with them all the time. But he actually believes that the way to create new wealth, more wealth, is to destroy it, okay, destroy it needlessly. And so, all right, that's the last of this particular slide. I apologize for going longer. I thought it might happen because you know, end up doing it, and my office is not air-conditioned, so it's getting pretty warm in here. But nonetheless, I'd love to have some questions from you in the time that we have remaining. And here's one here. Would you agree that regime – yeah, Krugman has gone after that whole thing about regime uncertainty. And he says, no, it's lack of aggregate demand. Businesses, it's not uncertainty. It's a certainty right now that there's no aggregate demand. And, I mean, he doesn't get it. He doesn't get it. That when you have a government like ours, which is utterly hostile to private enterprise, unless they're crony capitalists, unless they have some kind of ties with the government, And this is something that's been going on for quite a while, you know, that and especially, and by the way, look at what was the K Street Project about? I think that was called the K Street Project, the Republicans. It was about going up to businesses and saying, look, if you don't pony up and give money to the Republicans, the Democrats are going to come in and give you a hard time. They're going to mess. We're not going to get elected, and they're going to do all sorts of terrible things to you. By the way, we may do some terrible things to you, too. I mean, it's the whole issue of protection money, okay? And that's, folks, that's crony capitalism. That's at its worst. I mean, look what was the Microsoft antitrust suit about? It wasn't about messing up competition or, you know, somehow trying to convince people that a free browser was a really dangerous thing to the whole world and that we should continue to have $8,500 browsers that we have to, you know, instead of having it just provided for us when we buy a computer, because somehow if we don't pay for it, the world is going to collapse or something, or the economy is going to collapse, whatever. And it was like, you know, or when General Motors was, you know, I think they had a negative capitalization of $60 billion or something like that. And we're supposed to say that unless that company is saved, that the whole American economy is going to collapse, which is what they were saying at the Democratic National Convention. Doesn't make any sense. And so what we have is, you know, I mean, the Microsoft case, what was it about? It was – you had the false argument about the browser. But what it was really about was the lack of political contributions that were coming from not from Redmond, Washington, and also from Silicon Valley. These entrepreneurs tended to prefer to spend their money on other things. And what happened, I mean, look, for example, the Washington Post wrote, you know, Microsoft doesn't even have a presence in Washington. Like, how dare they not let us wet our beak? Well, they've got a nice big, you know, big office building in Reston, Virginia now. So, you know, they understood that. And by the way, what's happened at Silicon Valley? You know, it's basically now entrepreneurs suing each other. A lot of that engine is being slowed down because the politicians put their hands in it, okay? I guess that's what we call aggregate demand. But that, yeah, businesses are sitting on cash and stuff like that, which is what happened during the 1930s. Yeah, exactly right. Obama comes out there and tells these people, you didn't build that. Hey, the government did it. You know, or collectivism did it. Everybody else did it. You had nothing to do with it. It's like, oh, really? You know, that's his attitude towards entrepreneurs. You didn't build that. Yeah. It's a version of animal spirits, okay? I hadn't used that term animal spirits, but that's exactly right. Zachary, you're absolutely right. I did not bring Say's Law in here at all, but on my blog, on my Krugman in Wonderland blog, I have written a lot about Say's Law. I haven't done anything in that blog for a few months. We had some family issues, and I just had to devote my time elsewhere. I'm probably going to come back out again, you know, to it. But absolutely about Say's Law. I had a piece a couple of years ago in the Quarterly Journal of Austrian Economics on the Say's Law and the Austrian business cycle. And exactly right, though, because one of the things I'm talking about here is the real relationships between goods, entrepreneurs taking factors of production, finding new ways to use them, finding ways to make things at a lower real cost, and ultimately making more goods, which means that more people can have them. And, you know, that's what capitalism does. And it has, you know, it's not about aggregate demand. The demand comes from what we produce. It's exactly right. I absolutely agree with you there. Would laissez-faire, it would depend what you mean by that. I mean, you know, some of the Austrians like to say, look, folks, we can't have any kind of we cannot have any kind of fractional reserve bank. There's a big thing with that. I mean, right, what you have right now, people don't understand with the banks. Oh my gosh, I mean, they're just in bed with the government. Okay, by the way, I'm going to give you some links here. The first one is Krugman's Not Enough Inflation, where he says we need more inflation. Here's something about the space aliens. That one's always fun. And let's see. Here's my blog on Krugman. It's called Krugman in Wonderland. I named it after the Forbes article. Somebody else gave it the title, by the way. I didn't give the article the that title, but the hangover theory from Krugman. Here's that link there. All right, Bob Murphy often deals with Krugman. You know, he wanted to debate Krugman, and that never came about. But Bob's got a very interesting blog, and I think it's definitely worth reading. This is the Krugman endorses higher energy costs as a way to stimulate the economy. I mean, you know, you can't make this stuff up, all right? And, oh, yeah, the attack on Henry Hazlitt, by all means, you know, and I'll make that link available as well. All right. I think that, you know, what we're talking about here, it's karaoke. I've never heard Bob do karaoke. I guess maybe I should. Jonathan, absolutely. Absolutely. Paul Krugman received Nobel in 2008 for some stuff that he'd written on trade theory nearly 20 years before. But why was it Krugman? Because Krugman was after Bush. The Swedes hated George W. Bush, okay? And maybe for good reason, but nonetheless, he was the biggest critic of the Bush administration. By the way, at that time, war wasn't good for the economy. Okay, war was bad because it was being waged by Republicans. Okay, well, no, war was bad because it was being waged, period. And it was, you know, very, very destructive, and not to mention, you know, lots and lots of people get killed. But yeah, it was a politically motivated thing. Would Krugman have gotten it for his trade theory without all the New York Times columns? Good question. It was. In fact, it was what he'd written on. And some of it's interesting. I mean, you know, Paul Krugman at one time in his life was, you know, I think at least not as an obnoxious, you know. Yeah, he talks about monopolistic competition. I've read some on it. The thing about it with Krugman, once he became so involved as as a critic of free markets and, you know, and a promoter of Keynesianism, then, I just kind of lost interest in anything else he was doing. But absolutely right. Yeah, he's endorsed free trade in the past. But you know, I suspect that the guy would prostitute himself enough. He doesn't seem to have a lot of principle. I think he'd prostitute himself enough to be against it if Obama was against it. You know, if Obama all of a sudden came out and said, we're going to, you know, quadruple all our tariffs, I think that he would find a way to probably support it. Let's see. If everyone, old said, everybody saves their gold at the same time, would the economy still flourish? If so, why? Well, again, you got to understand that, and Murray Rothbard's pointed this out, that there's no set amount of money that the economy needs. As long as prices are allowed to adjust, and in fact, and let's really be honest, that the relationships that are there within the economy, talking about among the factors of production, really are barter type relationships, that the more inflation we have, the more those relationships become distorted, okay? That as much as possible, you want these relationships, these real relationships, the value of, say, oil to something else, you want these real relationships to reflect, reflect what consumers are doing. Okay, I think that's a really important point. That, you know, that's what you want to see. You want these relationships to reflect the choices that consumers are making. Okay. And what they would make in a free market and what they would make in a real market interest rate. Okay. And I think that's another thing, that you have to have a real live natural rate of interest. Right now, by the way, interest rates need to go up. And what would happen, yeah, in the short term, it would get pretty messy. And there's no doubt about that. And nobody is politically willing to do what's necessary. That's why, you know, that it's hard to be optimistic. I mean, back in 1982, you know, for all his faults, Ronald Reagan, now, they did some intervention. They didn't do near as much intervention in the economy as other people had done before. And, you know, look, I mean, places like Pittsburgh, you know, they had 7 miles of steel mills and related industries up and down the Allegheny and Monongahela rivers. And most of that stuff is gone. All right. That the recession of 1982 really exposed just, you know, where things, you know, the what they call the old economy, that was just these guys couldn't produce at any level of efficiency at all. They were extremely high cost producers. General Motors managed to get away with it for a while, but I mean, you know, you knew 30 years ago they were the highest cost producer in the business. And you know, they couldn't get rid of it because they had all the union contracts. And they didn't even seem to recognize the problem, apparently. Okay. Do we have more questions? No, I think that, yeah, let me see what. Hey, I appreciate that, Christopher. I really do. And where are you writing from, by the way? Hey, I'm cute. You know, like I said, I know you guys were from all over. Okay, New York. Well, great. Are you in the city or upstate? Okay. I still love the city. I still do. I still love to go to New York. I mean, you know, food is always good there. That's one thing I will say for the Fed. They had good food and wine, and so, you know, at the stuff and at their meeting. So, it was, you know, if I could go there and eat, you know, the Fed's food and drink some of their wine, why then, you know, I would definitely love that. But I hope all of you got something out of it. And I know I went, you know, a lot of time. I really, really appreciate the questions. I think they're good questions. I hope that, that people really do, you know, enjoy this. Yeah. Let me see that Sweden's gifted. Yeah, I know it. Oh, yeah. He definitely keeps, you know, it's the gift that keeps on taking. Yeah. Thanks all of you, you know, to all of you there. Well, I hope maybe I can. If this works out, why then maybe I will be doing some more things. You know, I enjoy doing this kind of stuff a lot. And by the way, see, my courses, my MBA courses are online. And, you know, I will have you know that I do teach also in economics in the MBA. What do I think about Krugman's statement? I think it's ridiculous. The U.S. debt level, what he's talking about, folks, is inflating our way out of it. Okay, that's why he says we don't have enough inflation. That he's just assuming that we could just continue to borrow. Here's something that I think that people don't understand. Why do we have a lot of consumption right now? We talk about all these goods being made overseas in China and in Asia in general. It's because other countries are still accepting dollars. But we are absolutely abusing the dollar. And what's going to happen, you know, I've been there before. Back in 1971, nearly 40 years ago to the day, because it's the 15th of August, Richard Nixon gives his famous, stage one or what is phase one speech on the economy, you know, cuts the gold and all that. People weren't all that, excited about accepting dollars. For a while, Americans overseas all of a sudden found other countries weren't so willing to, to accept the dollar. And, it could happen again. Yeah, it's supposed to be temporary and all that. Yeah. We had price controls on gas and oil from 1971 to 1981. That was temporary. And it caused a mess. Yep. Now, I remember that, too. I was getting ready for my freshman year in college. And I do remember all that. And, you know, at the time that I understand the implications, no, I didn't. But, nonetheless, there it was. Yeah, nothing. Let me see. Oh, yeah. He's saying, well, deficit's going down, you see, and so so we don't need to cut spending. And, you know, folks, you know, all I can say is that private enterprise, it's still amazing how much burden they can still carry. But, you know, we've raised now, in my generation, a whole generation of people who are absolutely hostile to the free market. And, you know, we have a president right now in Congress that's hostile to the free market. Academia, you know, I'm in academia. I can tell you of the utter hostility toward the free market there. And people aren't even civil libertarians anymore. Now that Obama is, you know, torturing Bradley Manning, hey, well, maybe torture is a good thing, you know. In fact, yeah, I agree with you there, Leslie. And by the way, you know, Paul Krugman a while back was a paid advisor. Okay, time check, 9 o'clock. I guess it's time to go, right? But I really appreciate all of you showing up and your questions and
Dr. Anderson
comments.
Feel free to finish your story.
But anyway, he's paid advisor to them, and he was the one who advised that they build lots of tunnels and roads and bridges to nowhere. Okay, and he claims that hey, Japan would have really had a deep recession. Well, I think if you want to go back to Doug French's talk on, and I have my MBA students listen to it, okay? Doug French's talk on what really happened in Japan. They wouldn't allow liquidation. They just kept propping everything up. And so that's where it goes. What you got to understand, folks, the law of scarcity still holds. And the reason we have idle capital is because, you know, either it's malinvested or the government itself is creating such a burden that we're having to, you know, to put our energies and our funds elsewhere. And, you know, it's just, we're paying dearly for this huge burden of government that we have. And, you know, I see it, you know, I'm way up in the mountains. I live in Garrett County, Maryland, and it's a very sparse county, but up on the ridgetops, we're seeing lots and lots of windmills. I live up about 2,600 feet, and our whole county, I think, is well above 2,000 feet. And all these ridgetops, they get wind, and so they're building wind farms everywhere. And, you know, every time I look at them, I just, you know, I think, my gosh, you know, every time that blade turns around, you're losing more money. And we're paying for it. We have to, with Krugman, he believes it's just all, hey, we're just, you know, borrowing, paying. We're not really paying for it. We are paying for it. We're paying for it with real factors of production. We are diverting factors of production to unprofitable uses, okay? And as Peter Schiff says, we're destroying wealth. That's what we're doing. And that's the sad thing, is that they talk about building an economy, and what they're really doing is destroying wealth. And that's the sad part. Okay. I guess that's probably enough there because now everybody's going to get tired. But I agree with you. I agree with you. You know, that everybody wants a free lunch is exactly right. Hey, I got free lunch up in Fed, right? Fed conference. But, you know, it is a tough situation, and it's not. Right now, it's not getting better, and that's the sad thing. All right. Okay, any other questions or any comments or anything? All right. Well, thank you so much, everybody. And hey, thank you, Danny, for all the stuff that you've done behind the scenes, okay? And Danny Sanchez, and I think we ought to really appreciate what he's doing because Danny – and, you know, it's 6 o'clock. Everybody else at the Mises Institute is gone, and Danny's still there because he's trying to help me keep me from, from pushing the wrong buttons. So anyway, I really, really appreciate, you know, I appreciate all of you being here and for the good reception. Okay. All right. Well, you guys take care. Okay. All right, Danny, I guess that's about it. I'd like to stay on, so chat with you just a minute, okay?